Finding a steady, good-paying job is one of the most effective ways for ex-offenders to stay out of prison, but there are all sorts of things that make that difficult. For Lisa Creason of Decatur, state law barred her from becoming a registered nurse.
When they told me I couldn't be a nurse, at first I wanted to give up because I felt like I've done so much and I've made so many changes, not just for me, but for the betterment of the community.
That's Lisa sharing her story with the Illinois Policy Institute about how she actually helped change state law for her and thousands of others. She joins us this hour. Plus,
children, whether they're in Syria or America, they're all our children. And as moms, we have the most powerful voice there is to speak up for them, but we need to speak up.
That's Chicago mom Becky Carroll, co-founder of the group Stand With Aleppo. We'll hear from her. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Lisa Creason has her degree in nursing. She's worked for years as a nursing assistant, but the state wouldn't let her take a test to be certified. That's because 20 years ago, she tried to steal cash from the register of a fast food restaurant. At the time, state law blocked her and anyone with some types of felony convictions from receiving licenses in certain fields.
I felt stuck in this house, and I felt like I was meant to be in the hood, like I was meant to be on government assistance, like I was meant to be held below a certain level. And then God said, no, you're not. You're here because I chose you to make this change.
That change included helping pass a new law that allows Lisa's and others with what's called a forcible felony on their record to petition for a license, thanks to the Illinois Policy Institute for that audio. Lisa Creason talked about her experience last week at a panel in Decatur. She's on the phone with us now. She's a community activist, a mom, and a nursing assistant in Decatur, where she joins us from. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And I should start with congratulations, because you're set to take the test to become a nurse in January. Is that correct?
That is correct. And thank you. I'm so excited.
Now, in August, that's because Governor Rauner signed Senate Bill 42, the legislation that you helped advocate for. Lisa, what does this legislation do?
Well, what Senate Bill 42 does is it fixes the unintended consequences caused by the law in the first place. In 2011, our lawmakers passed a law that placed lifelong restrictions on there's over 120 careers, but in 2011, they addressed the healthcare field for individuals who have been convicted of forcible felonies. Now, forcible felonies can range anywhere from terrorism all the way down to burglary. So there's really no method to that madness. There's like 20 different crimes that fall into that category, and some of which are nonviolent offenses, as mine. However, if you fall into that category, you were restricted from obtaining licensure in Illinois. So Senate Bill 42 lifts that restriction and allows for an individual to petition for their licensure after they've completed whatever required schooling is required for their choice of career, whether it be nursing, respiratory therapist, x-ray technician. I mean, there was a lot of different careers that fell into that one area.
And for you, Lisa, you've been a nursing assistant for how many years?
Since 2005.
Wow. Okay. And what does it mean now to have a registered nurse license? What does that mean for you and your family when you have the chance to do that in January? How will that change things for you?
Well, see, what it will do for me and hundreds of other people across Illinois is it will allow us to become self-sufficient and to be able to contribute to our family's financial security. Many people like myself are currently on some form of government assistance. I was upon completion of my schooling, I was on subsidized housing, food stamps, medical card. Because I was so serious about not wanting to be a recipient of government programs, I voluntarily walked away from the housing one and then picked up a second job once I had graduated and I had the free time available. But for many of us, it's going to mean that we are able to buy our own food, pay for our own health insurance, possibly buy a home one day, because we will be able to earn the money to do that. And in addition to that, we will also be able to contribute more to the community and to our city with taxes and spending money.
Mm-hmm. What's the salary differential, Lisa? Like, in terms of an hour, I wonder if you could even break down for us for an hourly rate how much a registered nurse would get compared to a nursing assistant.
A nursing assistant, the typical going starting wage is anywhere from $10 to $12 an hour. For a registered nurse, however, brand new, just starting out, the going rate is usually anywhere from 24-ish to 28 an hour.
Wow. So immediately double the salary and maybe as much as three times as much. So that's a huge difference. Lisa, under the new law, what did you have to do in order to be able to apply to take the licensure exam?
Well, see, in 2005, I had already previously obtained a waiver from the state of Illinois to practice in the medical field because I had this 22-year-old felony. So my waiver is still standing because I'm still an active certified nursing assistant. However, that process is the process in which an individual needs to pursue in order to make Senate Bill 42 work for them.
Mm.
If they have a previous conviction and they do not have a waiver from the state of Illinois, then they need to apply for a waiver, and they can do that through the Department of Public Health in Springfield, Illinois. They will send you a packet. You can even go online and download it. But that's the process. And then it allows the individuals responsible for granting the waiver to look at each case on a case-by-case basis.
We've been speaking with Lisa Creason. She's been telling us about her path to getting her registered nursing license, her RN license that will happen in January, how much work she did on Senate Bill 42, which Governor Rauner signed earlier this fall. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Beth Johnson is the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. She works with ex-offenders across the state to help with jobs, housing, and other areas. Beth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Beth, as we're hearing Lisa's story, I wonder how many people in Illinois have criminal records or are in situations similar to what Lisa's been describing.
Well, according to a study by the National Employment Law Project, there are an estimated 3.9 million people in Illinois with a criminal record. And so that's not just somebody with a conviction. That's anyone that's ever been arrested has a criminal record. And so across the nation, the number is 1 in 3. Have at some point been arrested, have a criminal record. So the number of people that have convictions, there are many, but we don't necessarily label individuals that have a criminal record as an ex-offender, because sometimes you're arrested and not convicted. Sometimes you're convicted and not actually guilty of the offense which you pled to. And so we work with thousands of people with criminal records that vary across the spectrum.
And when we think about the link between unemployment and staying out of prison or having a record, whether that's an arrest record or not, I think what comes to mind for people right away is they think about, and there's been a lot of media coverage of the Ban the Box initiative, which was a rule that Illinois passed a couple of years ago. Many states have that, which basically you're not allowed to ask until later on in the interview process whether or not someone's been convicted of a crime or getting into sort of their criminal background and their history. How much has some initiatives like that helped? Because I know there's been some recent studies as well. In fact, we had a conversation about this on the program, and we'll tweet out the link about how there's one study in particular that shows that actually maybe helps people who have a criminal background, but then hurts African-Americans in general across the board. So I wonder, what are we seeing? Like, is the Ban the Box initiative, has that been something that's helped people with a criminal record in terms of employment?
I think it's a piece to the puzzle, but at the end of the day, employers are still faced with the decision whether or not they find out about the record in the beginning of the process or further into it. They need to know how to make individualized decisions, weighing both the candidate before them and the criminal record that comes up on the background check. I think we're moving slowly towards that. Ban the Box wasn't the perfect solution. It's a piece in it. But there is a prevalent problem we have in our society that good people are being barred from opportunities. And studies have shown those that have full-time employment for those leaving prison are less likely to end up back in prison because they have employment. And as a human level, just like Lisa speaks about wanting to pursue the career she was made for, employment can define a human being, right? It gives you a purpose to wake up in the morning. And if we're barring people because of their past, we're having a lot of people that are being disenfranchised from the right opportunities.
Mm. I mean, when you say that employment can define a human being, I wonder, as we're thinking about that, are there other ways that state and federal laws, the culture thing, I think I want to get to in a little bit and talk about that, the employer culture and all of that stuff. And Lisa, I'd love to hear your perspective on that, too. But Beth, I want to ask you first, are there other ways that state and federal laws are preventing people from finding jobs?
I mean, absolutely. There are a cataloged 45,000 collateral consequences in the United States. A collateral consequence is every implication against a person after they serve their sentence. 45,000 laws that say you can't work here, you can't live here, you can't get this license, you can't be in this school. So we've done really good as a nation about imposing all these barriers, and now our challenge is to slowly start rolling those back. We want it done quickly. It's happening slowly. SB 42 was a great example of that, rolling back these thousands of laws that are posing lifetime barriers to self-sufficiency.
And then apart from the laws, there is the whole cultural point. Lisa, what has been your experience with employers? What do you think needs to change in terms of a culture of having people like you have the ability to, for example, in your case, have a full RN license?
Well, see, I think there's a lot we can do on that. First of all, when individuals like myself come home from prison, it's already very discouraging because you face so many obstacles and limitations. And a lot of times people don't know if they should be honest going to an interview or how they should present themselves going into an interview. And I think we need to have some of those programs available for individuals prior to coming home so that they're not caught so off guard. But for the employers themselves, there's a stereotype that automatically comes into play when you mention someone has a felony record or a criminal record. And we really need to move past that as just human beings, because everyone has a past and everyone has done something in their life at one point or another that they're not proud of, whether it was an illegal action, a legal action, or an immoral action. We all know what it's like to regret something that we've done. And we need to lean on that side of our humanity and give people a second chance and just judge them based on what they've done since the mistake and not the mistake itself, because the mistake does not define us as people.
I appreciate you saying that, Lisa. Beth, I wonder how many people even have a chance to prove themselves because they aren't even given an opportunity to find work. Do you think that's often the case?
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I'd say more often than not that's the case,
right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, Lisa, that's what you think. Beth, what do you think?
I think that people are prevented from being able to display the human being they are today. All too often, that black and white piece of paper is what an employer has historically been used to using as a screening tool. And employer education is a huge component, too. We can't be changing laws and not be changing hearts and minds at the same time. A lot of that comes along with exposure. Now that you are allowed to consider somebody with a criminal record if you were previously a regulated industry, how do you make those decisions? How do you make the best decisions for your place of business in hiring the best candidates? And so part of advocacy around these issues can't just be changing laws and educating people with criminal records, but it's also educating employers or landlords or institutions so we take full effect and start changing our views overall in society.
Beth, we're just about a minute to the break. I just wanted to ask quickly if you could tell me what those regulated industries are now that we've talked about, nursing, for example. What are the industries now that as of January will be covered under this new law?
So SB 42 deals with healthcare licenses. A bill was passed to remove lifetime barriers to employment for previous drug convictions for schools and park districts. So those were all a package of bills that made their way through the Illinois General Assembly, being led by people like Lisa, those that are the experts because they are the ones living this and making sure we're rolling back these lifetime absolute barriers in our laws in Illinois.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Beth Johnson. She's the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. We're also going to be talking about an event that's going to be taking place in Champaign County to help people with expungement and records. I want to thank Lisa Creason. I know, Lisa, you've got to get back to work, so I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Lisa Creason from Decatur, where she works there at a nursing facility. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us.
Not a problem. You guys have a good day.
All right. You have a good day. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about ex-offenders, people who have a criminal background, the challenges that are posed with getting people who have this background to employment. We were just hearing from an ex-offender, Lisa Creason, one of the people who lobbied very hard for Senate Bill 42, which is now will take effect in January. That is for people in the nursing industry for certain categories, now allowing them to allow for full licensure. My guests are Beth Johnson. She's the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. They work with ex-offenders across Illinois on issues related to jobs, housing, and other areas. Beth, just before we took a break, we were just talking about different challenges. We were talking about laws. I know that you all at Cabrini Green Legal Aid, you run a help desk. What are the typical problems that you see playing out for people in the work that you do with getting back to employment? How much of is it what Lisa was saying about people coming out of prison and then not even being clear about what resources are available to them?
I think people leaving our state institutions, our prisons, definitely have a more difficult time because of the lack of support and resources upon returning home. And we do see individuals that come directly from prison to our help desks. But as I mentioned before, we serve people with criminal records, and that could be anything from an arrest to a conviction. We meet people across the spectrum that haven't been arrested in 20 years. We meet people that are still getting arrested today because the criminal system impacts people's lives in so many different ways. And so what we do is have attorneys available five shifts a week. We see about 5,000 people a year that come to us because they've experienced some barrier, right? They're trying to get a job and they were told no because of their record. They're trying to get an apartment but couldn't move in because the landlord screened them out. They're trying to be licensed in some profession, but they can't because of their record. So our services are there, but it's often reactionary to a barrier. 92% of the people that come to us list the reason that they're coming is to find employment or better employment because of some barrier they've faced because of what's on their criminal record.
Mm. And when we think about that, 92% of people who are coming to see you are trying to find employment, first of all, or better employment. How often is it the case that laws like Senate Bill 42 pass and then people may not even be aware that this change has happened?
That's a huge issue across any policy agenda item that you would find, is that passing a bill is one thing. Making sure people know about it and it's implemented is a whole second stage of the process to complete it. The coalition we worked with, the Restoring Rights and Opportunities Coalition of Illinois, is comprised of policy folks, organizers, and the real experts, people with records that are experiencing these barriers, like Lisa, who take the time to travel to Springfield to share their stories and the impact of these laws and regulations. In terms of what bills are actually being worked on at this time and were passed, those were big industries. Schools are a big employer. Park districts are big employment, especially for young people. And might I mention, the park district bill that just passed changed the law because previously kids who were adjudicated delinquent as a juvenile were even barred from working in park districts because of drug offenses on their record. And those are things that we just need to change as a society. And there was a really good leadership example shown this year in Springfield.
As we are talking about this, I want to bring two more people into this conversation as we're talking about not just juvenile records, but also expungement and other records. Katie Blakeman is with the Champaign County Circuit Clerk. Beth is actually working with her with Cabrini Green Legal Aid for an event this weekend in Champaign. It's called the Expungement and Record Sealing Summit. Katie's in studio with us now. Hey, Katie, welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we are going to get to juvenile records in a few minutes with Karina Lopez, who's with the Illinois Justice Project, to the point that you were making earlier, Beth, about juvenile records in particular. Let's start with adult records and Katie Blakeman. Katie, you're the Champaign County Circuit Clerk, and you're organizing this event. Can you explain for us, first of all, I think maybe we should define terms. This is an expungement and record sealing summit. What does expungement mean?
So expungement is a remedy that is available to some people with criminal records that if they petition the court to have that record expunged, if it is granted, what happens with that record is that the police agencies, the arresting agencies, actually either return those records to you or destroy them. And then the record in the circuit clerk's office, who is the county keeper of the record, and the state police restrict greatly the access to those records. So it's no longer public record. Even law enforcement does not have access to those records. So expungement is the most sort of
extreme example.
Sealing
just means obviously then people don't have if a record is sealed, who has access to a sealed record?
So it's a very limited. It's only with court order. So for example, if that person is it certainly is removed from public record. So it's not going to show up on a search. You know, a lot of counties have a public search process on their websites. You can search for criminal records. It's not going to show up there. It wouldn't show up on a background check.
So it wouldn't show up on a background check.
It would show up on a fingerprint background check. And law enforcement, if you were applying to become a police officer, it would show up there, but it would not show up.
But what if you were doing fingerprints for working with children or things like that? I know sometimes that happens.
Beth, I think, would have a better answer.
Yeah, Beth, I wonder if you could start with that, Beth, because I have a question about when records are sealed, also about what the why don't we start with the fingerprinting? When a record is sealed, when does that show up?
So as Katie was correctly pointing out, law enforcement always has access to all sealed records. So although removed from the public domain, law enforcement still has it for their purposes. When it comes to sealed records, only felony convictions that are eligible to be sealed and sealed by the court are available to employers that are regulated by law to conduct fingerprint-based background checks. These are industries such as schools, park districts, healthcare, children's service agencies, like you mentioned. So if somebody is sealing a record, the only thing that's able for them to see is a sealed felony conviction.
And what do you recommend, Beth? What do you tell people when, if they've gone through this process and they've had a record sealed, what do you tell job applicants or people who have these backgrounds about what they're supposed to disclose to people in a job process?
So for employers?
No, for the person. I'm sorry, what do you tell applicants for what they should disclose to an employer, a potential employer?
Yes. So for employers that aren't regulated by a law, applicants do not have to disclose those records. They're protected under our Illinois Human Rights Act from employment discrimination based on a sealed record. So they are no longer required to disclose that to potential employers that aren't regulated by a law.
And from your standpoint, Beth, how important is the expungement and record sealing process? How important a step is that for people in terms of then being able to get a job? Or as you said, 92% of the people that come to you are looking for either employment or better employment.
It allows them to not have to have that be part of the discussion, and the focus is solely on their qualifications for that job. So it does have a huge impact on individual lives. But I think the thing to point out is, even when you're not eligible to seal a conviction on your record, there are still other forms of relief that you could seek to improve your employment opportunities. Lisa mentioned a health care waiver before. There's things such as certificates of good conduct. You can still move forward in your life without a sealed record. And one of the really great things about the event that Katie Blakeman is putting on Saturday, it's bringing that information to people as well. Because expungement and sealing is great for those that are eligible, but there are many other things, too, to help people get back into the workforce.
Katie, how much of this event on Saturday, now this is available for people just within Champaign County?
So it's designed to assist people who have a record in Champaign County. So they may not actually live in Champaign County anymore, but perhaps were arrested in Champaign County or were charged in Champaign County. And so at this time, we're able to help people with Champaign County records.
Mm-hmm. And how important is it? Do you find that in as county circuit clerk for you that a lot of people, this sounds like it's a really difficult system to navigate in terms of paperwork and understanding the laws. And I imagine most people are not able to do the years of work that our previous guest, Lisa, did in order to figure out how to navigate the system and apply for all these licenses. I imagine something like this is designed to help people with this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the primary purpose of holding an event like this. This is the first event that we've had in Champaign County, but Cook County has had a similar type of event for more than 10 years. I actually attended their annual summit last summer, and at that time was incredibly inspired by what they were able to do in Cook County. So the majority of the people that we see coming into our office, and we hear very similar stories. You know, we hear people telling us that, I was arrested 20 years ago, or, I got court supervision. It wasn't even a conviction. And, it's still preventing me from getting a better job or getting a job at all. It's preventing them from moving forward and supporting their families. And so because the majority of the people are looking for employment or for better employment, they typically do not have a lot of financial resources. And so hiring an attorney to help them figure all of this out is really just a pipe dream. I mean, that it for most people, it's really, really not possible. So this particular event brings together attorneys, volunteer attorneys who can assist people with viewing their criminal record and helping them figure out, based on what's there, what remedies might you be eligible for, and then assistance in completing the petition. And then, because it is an event hosted by the Circuit Clerk's office, and we have permission from the court to have a special court day, meaning we can accept filings on a not Monday through Friday basis, they'll actually be able to file the petition with us that day. And accompanying that is a blanket fee waiver, because there's typically filing fees associated with filing petitions for these forms of relief. And so we are able to accept those filings for free
Oh, that's
on
great.
Saturday, which is just a huge, huge huge thing for this.
That's Katie Blakeman. We're going to tweet out information about the Champaign County event. And there's one last issue that I wanted to get to with Karina Lopez. Karina, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We were just talking about Cook County. We were also talking about juveniles. And as Katie's been going through this very lengthy process for adults, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the Expungio app that you've developed to help help juveniles expunge their records. We mentioned 3.6 million adults. How are there are thousands of juveniles in Illinois, is that correct, Karina, who haven't been able to expunge their juvenile records?
Right. So there was actually recently a report published by the Illinois Juvenile Justice Commission about juveniles and the expungement rates. And it studied the arrest records of juveniles between 2004 and 2014. And there is approximately 1.8 million arrests within those 10 years. And for every 1,000 arrest records, only 3 were expunged. So that's not even 1%. That's 0.29%.
Wow.
Which is drastic and really needs some addressing.
And we've been talking about resources at this event. You helped develop an app a couple of years ago. What does the app do?
So the app is primarily a connection to resources. For a young person, as it's been said, it's been difficult to find people that can help them, but they definitely are out there. So this website aims to first help someone find out if they're eligible to expunge their record and if whatever offense they have qualifies under the expungement statutes. And then it'll connect them directly to some folks that are volunteering or helping out at the Juvenile Expungement Help Desk, and that's staffed by the Cabrini Green Legal Aid and Legal Assistance Foundation. So that's great on their work, and they've done a lot for them.
How many people, this app's been around for a couple of years, how many people have used it, Karina?
So right now we're still going to be tracking that just because it is hard. There's a connection point that's hard to track. So a lot of people can visit the website and find out if they're eligible, but there is sometimes difficulties for youth to continue on the process because it can be long and it can be complicated. So once they're talking to lawyers and see that, you need to go to this.
So it's really to connect people, right?
So right,
it's resources. Right. I know this was developed when you were with the MCFA Challenge Juvenile Justice Council. I wonder, Karina, as we've been talking about all of these issues, how important do you think it is for people who have juvenile records to make sure that they are having those either expunged or sealed, which they can do it sounds like they can start to do with the app. How important is that?
Well, I think it's really important to consider what Beth and Katie have said, that it is important to get it done because that's going to remove some barriers to education, employment, and housing and any other kind of opportunities in the future. But also you can still go on with the record, especially since it's juvenile. It should be kept confidential. But that report I mentioned also highlighted some broad sharing, both in the legal and illegal perspective. So it's important to do it, but also to remember that you have the right to do so.
Right. And it sounds like that's a lot of echoing the themes of what we've been talking about today, for people to know the rights that they have. I want to thank Karina Lopez. She's with the Illinois Justice Project, for sharing with us about the Expungio app. We'll tweet out the links to that. We'll have that all at our website, www.21stshow.org, so you can see those resources. I want to thank also Katie Blakeman, Champaign County Circuit Clerk. The event is in Urbana from 8:30 to 5 o'clock on Saturday, the Expungement and Record Sealing Summit. It's free. We'll tweet out that information. We've got it all on our website as well. I want to thank Katie Blakeman as well as Beth Johnson with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Beth, it sounds like Cabrini Green Legal Aid is really doing a lot of work on this throughout the state. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with a Chicago mom who started a hashtag Stand With Aleppo. She wants Chicago parents to be concerned about Syrian children. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The picture of a dirty, scared 5-year-old Syrian child, Amran Dagnish, in Aleppo, after he was pulled from the rubble after an airstrike is an iconic one. And that, among many others shared of children in Syria, have outraged many around the world, including two Chicago moms who are leading a campaign on social media called #StandWithAleppo. The campaign launched on October 2nd, the goal to engage Americans and moms specifically to help Syrian children. Joining us now is one of the co-founders of this, Becky Carroll. She's a Chicago mom, part of the #StandWithAleppo group, to talk about this movement that she's created. Becky, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
I thought we should start by explaining the situation in Aleppo. We know there's 100,000 kids in eastern Aleppo who are trapped in a bombing zone. Even a recent UNICEF report recently said, was titled No Words Left to Describe the Suffering of What's Happening with Children There. Becky, how involved of this in this story, in what's going on in Syria? Where did you start sort of intersecting with this?
Sure. I think it really started more than a year ago with the photo of that little toddler who washed up on the shores of Greece. And it just really, I think as a mom, it hit me and many other moms in a way that, you know, perhaps would not have registered had we not have our own children, our own toddlers at home. And Wendy Wiedem and I decided that we wanted to do something to help refugees, not only refugees that were here, but to do whatever we could to help bring other refugees to Chicago. So we became very engaged with both international and Chicago-based organizations that have been working with refugees either here on the ground or in camps over in Jordan and Turkey. And then my co-founder, Wendy Wiedem, who also doubles as the social media manager at CBS2, got engaged in a story around doctors in Chicago who had worked in hospitals in Aleppo. And they put us in contact with a doctor out there, a young doctor who we call Dr. Omar. We befriended him over social media. We talked to him almost every single day, I think in part to give him an outlet for someone else to talk to, but also really just to learn more and more personally connect with what's going on the ground. And then just a few weeks ago, his hospital was bombed along with others. And we were just shocked by the lack of attention being paid to by the media and by the international community. And I think the frustration was so great that Wendy and I decided to do something to channel our frustration and maybe give an outlet for other mothers like us to galvanize our voices and others to just speak out about it. So that's when we decided to launch the #StandWithAleppo campaign. It just started with a few friends on a Facebook group that we created. We created a banner with a photo of one of Dr. Omar's young patients, a 2-year-old named Doa, who unfortunately died a few days after we launched the campaign. And it's been a very satisfying experience, but still very frustrating given that, you know, virtually no progress has been made on reaching the goals we care about, which is both ending the bombing and opening the road in Aleppo to both medical and food supplies.
And Becky, I want to get to those goals in a minute, but I just want to go back to the conversation that you've been having with this doctor. Do you talk to him almost every day?
Yes, every single day. It's amazing that, you know, despite the fact that he is, you know, facing trauma 24/7, except for the few breaks in time when bombings have ceased, he is one of the only doctors who remain there. Well, really, the only doctor that remains there that does neurosurgery.
And what do you guys talk about?
You know, we mostly try really just to talk about normal things and keep his spirits up, what he's reading about, what we're doing with our kids every day. And oftentimes we then tread into what's happening on the ground. I know it's very difficult for him to talk about because he's the one that's in the emergency room seeing these children come into his care who are literally bombed to bits, who have become immediate orphans because they've lost their entire family, who are crying out for their parents, and there's no one there to comfort them other than him and his colleagues. And he's only one of 30 doctors that remain. So we really try to focus on, like I said, keeping his spirits up, giving him an outlet to talk about things that can help to some extent maintain a sense of normalcy for him as much as that is possible. But it's really also an incredible eye-opening bird's eye view that he has that he's willing to share with us about what he is seeing, not only with the children and families that come in, but really what the people of Aleppo have been experiencing day after day after day. And we're talking about a city that, by most standards, was very modern, very westernized. There are Christians, Muslims, all living in peace, almost a cosmopolitan city, much like Chicago, minus the skyscrapers, who enjoyed going out to restaurants and going to parks and doing all the things that you and I and others do here in America. And that has just been taken away from them.
And I wonder, when we think about that, as you're describing Aleppo and you're describing this relationship with this doctor, we know there's less than 30 doctors right now, I think, who remain within the area. When you think about American knowledge of the situation, and we think about, I know at one point you guys were trying to have this be some trending during the presidential debates because you wanted the presidential candidates to be addressing this. And I can't help but think of some other things that I saw during the most recent presidential debate where Merriam-Webster was sort of tweeting out different words people were searching for. And people, I actually saw something where people were actually looking for, they were searching for Aleppo, but they were saying, what is Aleppo? As in thinking it was two words, A and then Aleppo. And I think that maybe perhaps speaks to the lack of knowledge people have about what's going on. And I wonder how much of this is also for you all just sort of trying to get people aware of just what's happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were happy to see that, but also a little troubled to see it. And I think in general, for better or worse, most Americans, unless you are really personally impacted by something that is happening in another part of the world, you're just not aware. I wish that wasn't the case. But I think that's, again, why we decided that we wanted to do something to not just galvanize those who really wanted to take action, but really raise awareness. And that was also the motivation around our, what we call the hashtag Ask About Aleppo campaign, where for several days leading up to the presidential election and really in the 24 hours before it began, we focused heavily on tagging moderators and CNN and other outlets to try to make sure that they understood this is something that people wanted to hear about. So when they did actually ask about Aleppo, I think it validated a lot of work that had been done tirelessly on the part of not just the hundreds of members in our group, but really thousands who we found people tweeting and using the hashtag who had no direct affiliation with our group. And so we hope that the fact that, you know, Aleppo was the number one searched item that night, the fact that, you know, our hashtag trended on Twitter and that Aleppo trended number one on Facebook that night, there was an accomplishment in that more and more Americans are probably aware of what's going on there now.
And so what's your goal? Right. Like, you're targeting moms in particular. What do you want? How do you want people to be involved with this?
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, our ultimate goal is simply to advocate for an end to the bombings. I mean, people just can't live and get by day to day, going to bed every night and waking up every day, not knowing when they're going to start again. And also to open up the one road, Castello Road, that can bring in both medical and food to the city as they are running low on everything. I mean, they're using yarn in the emergency rooms to for surgeries. So, and people are dying of their injuries when in any other hospital in America, they'd be able to get, you know, attended to and out the same day. But that's not happening because they don't have the supplies they need. So we really want to end the bombing and open the road to Aleppo and continue to galvanize these voices to demand that international leaders are doing more than just, you know, talking about it. We need action.
both.
And what action, right, I guess what action do you want parents to take? I know that you had a conversation with people. I saw a conversation you had with someone on Twitter where you told people to speak up, and the response was, words aren't going to fix everything, anything. Like, every American
right.
could speak up, and this wouldn't stop. So.
Right. And I've encountered a lot of that. Fortunately, I think we've encountered a lot more, like, I want to help. Let me know what we can do. And I think for most people like me, I run my own business. I have a 2-year-old. I don't have the luxury of a lot of time, and neither do most of these other moms. But what they do have is the ability in their spare time to get on social media, share their thoughts, share stories, advocate with their other friends and their networks to do something about it. And I really truly believe that speaking up and making sure that leaders locally, internationally, see that there is a steady drumbeat and a growing drumbeat of those who want action, they're going to be more inclined to fight a little harder to get some kind of a resolution. I mean, if we remain silent, we'll continue to find ourselves in the same situation we've been in historically. Even John Kerry, Secretary Kerry, said that, this is the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II, and that's true. And we found ourselves in that crisis in World War II because we remained silent, and we just can't let that happen again.
So what you want people to do is to use the hashtag #StandWithAleppo to be advocating for an end to the bombing and to be opening up that road?
Yes. I mean, it's really that simple, because when you are posting that on your page, it's hitting the timelines of everyone who follows you. And then when they retweet it, it gets on the timelines of everyone who follows them. I mean, it's this multiplier effect that allowed us to force Aleppo, I think, into the social media stratosphere and ultimately get it added to the debate at the presidential election. I mean, that was something very tangible that all of these mostly moms who are advocating for this on social media to demonstrate that their efforts worked. Even if they spent 5 minutes that day trying to get the word out, that multiplied, and that resulted in something tangible and real that helped elevate Aleppo in a way that I don't think it had before, especially given the results on social media that night.
Becky, we just have about a minute left. How do you want people to get involved?
I think it's very easy to find, you go onto Twitter, you search #StandWithAleppo, you are going to find our members, you're going to find our tweets, you're going to find ways to connect with us, retweet what we're putting out there, get inspiration for leading your own campaign. This is really all about empowering individuals that want to take action and also do so collectively under an umbrella of others. So it's really easy to do, especially if you have the passion for it. And we're here to encourage and support everyone in doing so.
I wanted to ask you one last question. I know when I mentioned you're specifically targeting moms, people have been sharing pictures of their kids side by side with those in Syria. And you shared your daughter's picture, Riley, as well. I guess as a mom, I wonder how it makes you feel to see those pictures.
Well, I was inspired by political commentator Essie Cupp, who has been unrelenting in her push to get Aleppo into the hearts and minds of other moms. And I always tell people this, that if the table were ever turned and we found ourselves in a situation where we were under siege, wouldn't we want the rest of the world to speak up on our behalf and advocate for us? Wouldn't we want them to open our doors to our children? And if we can't demonstrate that we have the same compassion for others, then we've really lost our humanity and I think everything that we as Americans stand for. So we need to understand that, children, whether they're in Syria or America, they're all our children. And as moms, we have the most powerful voice there is to speak up for them, but we need to speak up.
Chicago mom Becky Carroll, one of the co-founders of the group. The hashtag is #StandWithAleppo, trying to get American moms in particular involved. Becky, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.